I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series called Talking Books, I shall be asking my guests about their personal relationship with the written word. I'm very pleased to have with me in the studio today Mike Rosner. Mike is currently head of Department of Intelligent Computer Systems here at the University of Malta and teaches courses in natural language processing, logic, and artificial intelligence for the university's ICT degree program and for Erasmus Mundus Joint Master's program on human language science and technology. His main research interests are natural language processing, with particular interest in Maltese language processing, natural language generation, e-learning, and semantic web. He co-organized the first ACL workshop on computational approaches to Semitic languages held in Montreal in 1988, and has since participated in the committees of the more recent workshops in the series. He was the local organizer and a PC member for EAMT with the special theme of Semitic languages held in Malta in 2004. He will be the local coordinator for the LREC conferences, a lot of acronyms going on here, in May 2010. And he has served for many years on the executive board of the Internet Foundation. He continues to coordinate research on the development of a Maltese language resource server, which involves the creation and distribution of lexical and computational resources. Welcome to you, Mike.
Thanks.
As we've seen from your short bio, you are really a language person, but obviously within an ICT framework. But perhaps you could describe a little bit for our listeners your professional relationship with the human language.
Okay, I'm sorry for all those acronyms. It's a disease of the computing profession, I'm afraid. Yeah, I mean, simply said, in a nutshell, my area of work is looking at human language and trying to find ways in which human language can be related to computers. And this is a very, very wide area, which takes in the analysis of language, the generation of language. It takes in spoken and written language. It takes in many different tasks, such as automatic translation, such as extracting the contents from things like newspapers into a form where they can be dealt with and treated and processed by machine, and also in simply everyday conversation with computers in a natural way.
It's a real combination of looking at what human language is related to the machine.
Exactly, exactly, and related to related to human communication, really. That's the...
Well, certainly the book that you've chosen to focus on today is really a monument to human communication and human language. It's The Diving Bell and the Butterfly by Jean-Dominique Bauby. And I'll ask you to give a little bit of a summary of what the book is about, because here we have somebody who is really managing to survive purely because of his ability really to communicate through language, but in the strangest of ways. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the background of the book.
Okay, well, essentially it recounts the remarkable life of Jean-Dominique Bauby, who used to be debonair editor of the magazine Elle in France. And in 1995, he suffered a massive stroke whilst driving his car. He slipped into a coma, which lasted for 20 days, and he awoke to find himself paralyzed from head to toe. He was diagnosed with a rare neurological disorder, which is referred to as locked-in syndrome. A prisoner inside his own useless body, Bauby, 43, could think, reason, smell, and hear, though not very well. With the only part of his body that he could move, his left eye, he could see, and later learn to express himself. He had a speech therapist, and later his friends would read him an alphabet, and Bauby would blink at the letter he wanted. So in this way, he was able to form words, phrases, and sentences. And ultimately, over the course of 2 months, working with ghostwriter Claude Mandibille, who took down the words, word for word, of what he said, he completed his memoir. And the memoir is the book, the Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
And why do you think, why does the book have this particular title? Because it is quite a strange title.
Well, I think really the book, in a way, is a monument to the human spirit, and the diving bell and the butterfly refers to, on the one hand, the diving bell. If you imagine a diving bell, it's something you go into and you enclose yourself inside of, and it insulates you from the outside world. The diving bell is his body, and his broken body, which no longer functions, apart from his eye, and his eyelid in particular, and his ears. So the diving bell is his broken body, whilst at the same time there is no limit to the things he can imagine. And he imagines his spirit and his memories are the butterfly, which rides above the body and can imagine all kinds of wonderful things, which are written about in the book. So that's the title.
Also the smell, that came across really, really well. The idea of him imagining or being able to smell the smells of the French cuisine.
Yes.
Where they would take him out and he could smell French fries. I think that its smell is such an evocative thing for any human being, even in a normal situation. You smell something and you suddenly remember something that happened, I don't know, in your childhood. And for him, the smell suddenly became terribly important. I don't know whether you promised me you were going to read a few words in translation, of course. I don't know whether you have anything on that particular subject.
I do, actually, I do have something, because he talks about, there's a chapter of the book is called The Sausage. And it turns out that this sausage is something which played a great role in his memory. I'll give you an idea. I have to apologize a little bit for the translation, which I did myself yesterday in a great hurry. But I think it's enough to give you the spirit of what it's about. So, for the pleasure of recalling his memory, the joys of French cuisine, I revert to my own memory of tastes and smells, an inexhaustible reservoir of sensations. There used to be the art of dealing with leftovers, but now I cultivate that of simmering the recollections. You can summon up a table at any time. If it's a restaurant, no need for a reservation. If I do the cooking, it always succeeds. The bourguignon is smooth, the beef in its translucent jelly. The apricot tart is always at exactly the right point of acidity. Depending on mood, I might offer myself a dozen snails, a choucroute garni, and a bottle of Gewürztraminer Vendange Tardive. Late raccolte, with its golden hue, or maybe a simple boiled egg with soldiers and salted butter. What a feast. The yolk of the egg penetrates my throat in a long, warm flow, and there is never a problem of digestion. Obviously, I only use the best products, the freshest vegetables, fish which have scarcely jumped out of the water, and meat perfectly preserved with parsley around it. Every day, everything must be prepared according to the rules. And to be absolutely sure, a friend sent me the recipe for the genuine andouillette of Troyes, made with three different kinds of meat entwined together in strips. In the same spirit, I scrupulously respect the rhythm of the seasons. At the moment, I am refreshing the taste buds with chunks of melon and red fruit. Oysters and game are for the autumn, if I can retain the desire, since I'm starting to become a little ascetic.
When you consider that this is a man who is being fed by a tube, really, it's a wonderful piece, isn't it?
It is.
And I think could only have been written by a Frenchman, though.
Very much so. I mean, the translation is poor by comparison to the original.
So when you first came to this book, did you read it for professional reasons or did you read it because somebody recommended it to you? And when you actually got into it, what was it about the book that you found particularly remarkable?
Well, I think to be honest, I didn't read it for professional reasons. There is an element at the beginning of the book in which he talks about the mechanism by which he learnt how to communicate with the person he calls the guardian angel, who's his speech therapist, and he devotes some time to her incredible patience and the the regrets he had, for example, for the fact that he really only had communication at any kind of deep level with the with his speech therapist and her assistant, and less so with the immediate members of his family, who were, you know, who visit. He describes several visits, and he talks about the difficulty of being on the end of a phone, for example, listening to a message and not being able to. What does the other person think when they just know that the person they're talking to cannot respond? What can they do? He sometimes had to sort of make a noise or cough or something like that to try and just to sort of maintain the conversation. But technically, then he learnt a code for transmitting the letters one by one by means of a method which was developed in collaboration with his speech therapist, which used the fact that certain letters were more frequent than others in French to minimise the number of eye blinks he had to make to convey certain letters. But that gives only a very small indication of the other things he was able to do. So that, for example, he was also able to, he was able to move his neck very slightly, and obviously he was able to move his eye. And in this way he was able to convey such messages as can you open the window, or can you turn the TV down. These special messages developed just by means of practice. So the book, professionally, I think one of the things it can certainly indicate is that yes, you can develop efficient codes for transmitting very, very low level information. What is amazing about this book is the way in which, I mean, as a literary work, it is superb. I mean, the choice of words, the choice of style is really extraordinary. And he had to convey a paragraph would have taken all day, and he had to memorize word for word what he was going to say in advance in order to be able to see the whole thing, because he had no other means to see the whole. You know, it was very, very difficult. So that's what I find extraordinary, is that with a limited channel of communication, he was able to go so far. I mean, we talk of the wonders of, we take as our basic method of communication face-to-face. You know, that is the sort of first-class communication. And then there are other means of communication which are sort of substitutes for that, in a way. So we have telephones, which they're real-time, but you don't have the picture. Now we have computers which give you the picture as well. In this book, what's amazing is it's rather a short book, but it's very, very rich, very, very dense, full of so many things. And, I mean, he didn't have much time to do it.
I don't know whether he knew. This person had a certain quality of life before his terrible accident that involved an interesting family life. He had children, he had a mistress, he says that in the book. He had that a wonderful tenor of life, he had money, and he suddenly found himself within this, what he refers to as a diving bell, basically his body. And yet somehow what comes out of the book, I think, is a certain quality of life which makes it so difficult to decide what is quality of life at the end of the day. I mean, it seems such a cruel situation and such a hellish situation, really, to be like that. And yet somehow he manages to retain a dignity throughout the book, throughout all the discussions that he brings in. What do you feel about that quality of life situation?
Well, I mean, at one level, one could say that he feels the deprivation because of the quality of life he had before, more than somebody who had a lousy life or was unhappy. So, there's no question about the fact that his quality of life after the event was pretty low. I mean, he managed to make the best of what there was. And the fact that he was able to draw on resources from his memory obviously made it possible up to a certain point for him to do that. I mean, if he hadn't had the rich life's experiences that he had, he wouldn't have been able to dig down. And supposing he'd been somebody who, without such memories or with a terrible existence up to that point, it's not clear that that he would have found the resources in himself to want to continue. But one gets the feeling, after the event he had a low quality of life, but he made the best of it.
He talks about the intervention of modern medicine as, I think it says, prolonging and refining the agony. And I think that's a very poignant way of putting it, really, because in a way you do feel that he almost regrets having woken up, but then on the other hand, he doesn't.
I don't know.
There
have been other related stories, not to do with this particular book, but there was a recent film, the name I can't now escape me, about a man who's an athlete he was a swimmer. He dived into the water. And he lost control of his body completely. And this man in the story I'm telling you about wanted to commit suicide, and he wasn't allowed to. And he went to court, and eventually he did commit suicide. And there's a whole issue about whether voluntary euthanasia is something which is admissible or not, which I think is woven into this whole issue. I didn't find in the book any place where he actually says, I would like to be dead. And I feel that, in a way, he had to write this book. The fact that he died subsequently was due to an infection that he got. He wasn't allowed to die. He could have gone. I mean, he got pneumonia and he died. I don't think I saw anywhere in the book any place where he thought that he should now pop off voluntarily or otherwise. I don't think that came.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have another quotation, I think, mention.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the things that comes through is there's an underlying. He's extremely observant. I mean, he wasn't a literary writer, as far as I can understand it. He was an editor of a magazine.
Sure.
So he comes through as being incredibly observant about all sorts of things, and humour is not lacking in some of the things that he writes about. One of the people he writes about is the doctor who he first meets in the hospital, who is kind of breaking the news of his current situation. Because when he wakes up, he doesn't really know what's going on. He just knows that he's becoming conscious of this kind of world, and he's surprised by the fact that he cannot speak, and he cannot move his body, and he thinks it'll be a matter of time. And the doctor is kind of putting him in the picture a little bit about the situation. And the first thing that happens, in fact, is that they sew up one of his eyes. And he thinks, why are you doing this? You know, why is this happening? And it's not fully explained in the beginning. He doesn't know why it's happening. He talks about this doctor. This is a bit of live translation, so it may not be perfect. He was the prototype Dr. Je m'en fous, Dr. I don't care. Haughty, arrogant, who for his consultations, inevitably scheduled for 8 o'clock, arrived at 9 and left at 9:05, having devoted exactly 45 seconds to each patient of his precious time. Over the weeks, I wondered whether the hospital deliberately chose such a rebarbative character to catalyse the blind fury that the medical personnel sometimes instilled in the minds of the long-term patients. To his eternal question, do you see double? I would not have the pleasure and the innocence to hear myself answer him, from my interior, yes, I'm seeing double. I'm seeing two idiots instead of just one.
I mean, one cannot imagine how frustrating it must have been for him not to be able to answer back and to be in this medical situation the whole time. It must have been a terrifying experience until he got used to it, if he ever did get used to it.
I don't think he ever got used to it. There are also very moving scenes where he's undergoing in his mind the most incredible emotions and feeling, this is the end. This is so terribly sad. And he feels himself, he's crying. And all this you can see from the outside is a small tear on this eye, and that's all. That's the only manifestation on the outside, but inside, it's all happening, you know. And that's again so difficult to imagine the pain of not even being able to express your emotions except through this very very slow method of words.
It's the pain of existing but not living within the parameters that we normally consider exactly. living to be within, really.
Yes.
There is also the issue of the film. We often come across this problem of does the book reflect reality? And if it does, will the film reflect reality? And in this case, I understand that although the film was greeted with great acclaim when it came out, there were some problems afterwards with his friends in the way that the film recounted certain aspects of Bobby's life.
Yes, I mean, and I think this is always a problem, but particularly a problem with when the people are still alive, as is the case here. So basically, we've mentioned already that he had a girlfriend. And in the, I mentioned also that he mentions that the mother of his children. He mentions her both in the book, and she also appears in the film. Now, so I'll there are differences between the real story here and the story as depicted in the film. So the biggest difference between the book and the film is the story of the women in his life. The movie shows Bobby, known to his friends as Jean d'Or, as an invalid babe magnet, and the women surrounding him as vying for his attention. Bobby doesn't write about this or anything like it in the book, although friends describe him as being very charming and with a great sense of humour, quick and sometimes biting. He was a bon vivant and engaging. One friend portrayed him as having power in his silence once he became ill. The major difference between the book and the film is that the mother of Bobby's children, which is how he refers to her in the film, pays him saintly visits day after day, despite the fact that he doesn't love her, and that the fact that the girlfriend that he is in love with never shows up at the hospital at all. In the most devastating scene in the movie, Bobby's girlfriend tells him on the phone that she can't come to visit him because she cannot bear to see him like that. He painfully spells out his response to the mother of his children so that she can interpret it to his girlfriend. Bobby's touching reply is that each day he waits for her, and at that point his wounded former partner slams the phone down and the audience withers with the pain of her rejection. Now that scene never took place, and in reality the girlfriend was the one who came to see him often, and as far as I can see the mother came to see him once. Now the girlfriend, during the events recounted in the book, slightly beforehand, they'd broken up. So there is some issues about whether the fact that the mother of his children was depicted in the film was something which is a bit of a kick in the teeth for the girlfriend. I don't know, but these are the issues which came up, and I think that there are difficulties here if the people who still are being around. Mentioned still around. I mean, there are moral judgments taking place which are being seen on the big screen, which may have not much to do with what happened in reality. And I think this is a difficult area.
It's a common problem. Well, I think that this sort of book can be really, perhaps to say life-changing is an exaggeration, but certainly one of those books which can make one stand back and sort of look at one's own existence and certainly appreciate what one has. And you cannot help but admire the enormous, very deep resources that this man had, and pray that if one anything like that were to happen to oneself, one would have the same resources as he certainly showed himself to have.
Yes, I mean, I think if you ask me to sum up what I feel are the enduring qualities in the man and the book, is that it depicts a mixture of qualities. I mean, tragedy, bravery, skill, hope, and humour. And I think that, and bravery in particular, I mean, how very brave to undertake this task of communication, which was the last task he did, actually, and to leave something behind, which is, I think, a legacy to all those things, which stands in its own right as something which people who are in similar or related situations can draw upon and take strength from, I think.
Well, thank you very, very much, Mike Grosner, for coming to talk to us about The Diving Bell and the Butterfly and Jean-Dominique Bobby's very difficult last years. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With me today in the studio was Mike Rosner. Do join me again next week when I shall be speaking to Claude Manjon. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.